Chapter 2. The Bringer of Light. Introduction. The picture of the human condition that emerges from the Nikayas, as sketched in the preceding chapter, is the background against which the manifestation of the Buddha in the world acquires a heightened and deepened significance. Unless we view the Buddha against this multidimensional background, extending from the most personal and individual exigencies of the present to the vast impersonal rhythms of cosmic time, any interpretation we may arrive at about his role is bound to be incomplete. Far from capturing the viewpoint of the compilers of the Nikayas, our interpretation will be influenced as much by our own presuppositions as by theirs, perhaps even more so. Depending on our biases and predispositions, we may choose to regard the Buddha as a liberal ethical reformer of a degenerate Brahmanism, as a great secular humanist, as a radical empiricist, as an existential psychologist, as the proponent of a sweeping agnosticism, or as the precursor of any other intellectual fashion that meets our fancy. The Buddha who stares back at us from the texts will be too much a reflection of ourselves, too little an image of the Enlightened One. Perhaps in interpreting a body of ancient religious literature, we can never fully avoid inserting ourselves and our own values into the subject we are interpreting. However, though we may never achieve perfect transparency, we can limit the impact of personal bias upon the process of interpretation by giving the words of the texts due respect. When we pay this act of homage to the Nikayas, when we take seriously their own account of the background to the Buddha's manifestation in the world, we will see that they ascribe to his mission nothing short of a cosmic scope. Against the background of a universe with no conceivable bounds in time, a universe within which living beings, enveloped in the darkness of ignorance, wander along bound to the suffering of old age, sickness, and death, the Buddha arrives as the torchbearer of humankind. Ukadharo, Manusanam, bringing the light of wisdom. In the other words of text 2.1, his arising in the world is the manifestation of great vision, of great light, of great radiance. Having discovered for himself the perfect peace of liberation, he kindles for us the light of knowledge, which reveals both the truths that we must see for ourselves and the path of practice that culminates in this liberating vision. According to Buddhist tradition, the Buddha Gautama is not merely one unique individual who puts in an unprecedented appearance on the stage of human history and then bows out forever. He is, rather, the fulfillment of a primordial archetype, the most recent member of a cosmic dynasty of Buddhas constituted by numberless perfectly enlightened ones of the past and sustained by perfectly enlightened ones continuing indefinitely onward into the future. Early Buddhism, even in the archaic root texts of the Nikayas, already recognizes a plurality of Buddhas who all conform to certain fixed patterns of behavior, the broader outlines of which are described in the opening sections of the Mahapadana Sutta, Digha Nikaya, 14, not represented in the present anthology. The word Tathagata, which the texts use as an epithet for a Buddha, points to this fulfillment of a primordial archetype. The word means both the one who has come thus, Tathagata, that is, who has come into our midst in the same way that the Buddhas of the past have come, and the one who has gone thus, Tathagata, that is, who has gone to the ultimate peace, Nibbana, in the same way that the Buddhas of the past have gone. Though the Nikayas stipulate that in any given world system, at any given time, only one perfectly enlightened Buddha can arise, the arising of Buddhas is intrinsic to the cosmic process, like a meteor against the blackness of the night sky. From time to time, a Buddha will appear against the backdrop of boundless space and time, lighting up the spiritual firmament of the world, shedding the brilliance of his wisdom upon those capable of seeing the truths that he illuminates. The being who is to become a Buddha is called, in Pali, a bodhisatta, a word better known in the Sanskrit form, bodhisattva, According to common Buddhist tradition, a bodhisattva is one who undertakes a long course of spiritual development, consciously motivated by the aspiration to attain future Buddhahood. Inspired and sustained by great compassion for living beings mired in the suffering of birth and death, a bodhisattva fulfills, over many eons of cosmic time, the difficult course needed to fully master the requisites for supreme enlightenment. When all these requisites are complete, he attains Buddhahood in order to establish the Dhamma in the world. A Buddha discovers the long-lost path to liberation, the ancient path traveled by the Buddhas of the past that culminates in the boundless freedom of Nibbana. Having found the path and traveled it to its end, he then teaches it in all its fullness to humanity so that many others can enter the way to final liberation. This, however, does not exhaust the function of a Buddha. A Buddha understands and teaches not only the path leading to the supreme state of ultimate liberation, the perfect bliss of Nibbana, but also the paths leading to the various types of wholesome mundane happiness to which human beings aspire. A Buddha proclaims both a path of mundane enhancement that enables sentient beings to plant wholesome roots productive of happiness, peace, and security in the worldly dimensions of their lives, and a path of world transcendence to guide sentient beings to Nibbana. His role is thus much wider than an exclusive focus on the transcendent aspects of his teaching might suggest. He is not merely a mentor of ascetics and contemplatives, not merely a teacher of meditation techniques and philosophical insights, but a guide to the Dhamma in its full range and depth, one who reveals, proclaims, and establishes all the principles integral to correct understanding and wholesome conduct, whether mundane or transcendental. Text 2.1 highlights this wide-ranging altruistic dimension of a Buddha's career when it praises the Buddha as the one person who arises in the world for the welfare of the multitude, for the happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the good, welfare, and happiness of devas and humans. The Nikayas offer two perspectives on the Buddha as a person, and to do justice to the texts, it is important to hold these two perspectives in balance without letting one cancel out the other. A correct view of the Buddha can only arise from the merging of these two perspectives, just as the correct view of an object can arise only when the perspectives presented by our two eyes are merged in the brain into a single image. One perspective, the one highlighted most often in modernist presentations of Buddhism, shows the Buddha as a human being who, like other human beings, had to struggle with the common frailties of human nature to arrive at the state of an enlightened one. After his enlightenment at the age of 35, he walked among us for 45 years as a wise and compassionate human teacher, sharing his realization with others and ensuring that his teachings would remain in the world long after his death. This is the side of the Buddha's nature that figures most prominently in the Nikayas. Since it corresponds closely with contemporary agnostic attitudes towards the ideals of religious faith, it has an immediate appeal to those nurtured by modern modes of thought. The other aspect of the Buddha's person is likely to seem strange to us, but it looms large in Buddhist tradition and serves as the bedrock for popular Buddhist devotion. Though secondary in the Nikayas, it occasionally surfaces so conspicuously that it cannot be ignored, despite the efforts of Buddhist modernists to downplay its significance or rationalize its intrusions. From this perspective, the Buddha is seen as one who had already made preparations for his supreme attainment over countless past lives and was destined from birth to fulfill the mission of a world teacher. Text 2.2 is an example of how the Buddha is viewed from this perspective. Here it is said, the future Buddha descends fully conscious from the Tusita heaven into his mother's womb. His conception and birth are accompanied by wonders. Deities worship the newborn infant, and as soon as he is born, he walks 7 steps and announces his future destiny. Obviously, for the compilers of such a sutta as this, The Buddha was already destined to attain Buddhahood, even prior to his conception. And thus, his struggle for enlightenment was a battle whose outcome was already predetermined. The final paragraph of the sutta, however, ironically harkens back to the realistic picture of the Buddha. What the Buddha himself considers to be truly wondrous are not the miracles accompanying his conception and birth, but his mindfulness and clear comprehension in the midst of feelings, thoughts, and perceptions. The three texts in section 3 are biographical accounts consistent with this naturalistic point of view. They offer us a portrait of the Buddha stark in its realism, bare in its naturalism, striking in its ability to convey deep psychological insights with minimal descriptive technique. In text 2, 3, 1, we read about his renunciation, his training under two famous meditation teachers, his disillusionment with their teachings, his solitary struggle, and his triumphant realization of the deathless. Text 2, 3, 2 fills in the gaps of the above narrative with a detailed account of the Bodhisattva's practice of self-mortification, strangely missing from the previous discourse. This text also gives us the classic description of the enlightenment experience as involving the attainment of the four jhanas, states of deep meditation, followed by the three vijjas, or higher types of knowledge, the knowledge of the recollection of past lives, the knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings, and the knowledge of the destruction of the taints. While this text may convey the impression that the last knowledge broke upon the Buddha's mind as a sudden and spontaneous intuition, text 2, 3, 3 corrects this impression with an account of the Bodhisattva on the eve of his enlightenment, reflecting deeply upon the suffering of old age and death. He then methodically traces this suffering back to its conditions by a process that involves, at each step, careful attention, yoniso manasikara, leading to a breakthrough by wisdom, panyaya abhisamaya. This process of investigation culminates in the discovery of dependent origination, which thereby becomes the philosophical cornerstone of his teaching. It is important to emphasize that, as presented here and elsewhere in the Nikayas, see below, pages 353 through 359, dependent origination does not signify a joyous celebration of the interconnectedness of all things, but a precise articulation of the conditional pattern in dependence upon which suffering arises and ceases. In the same text, the Buddha declares that he discovered the path to enlightenment only when he found the way to bring dependent origination to an end. It was thus the realization of the cessation of dependent origination, and not merely the discovery of its origination aspect, that precipitated the Buddha's enlightenment. The simile of the ancient city, introduced later in the discourse, illustrates the point that the Buddha's enlightenment was not a unique event, but the rediscovery of the same ancient path that had been followed by the Buddhas of the past. Text 2, 4 resumes the narrative of text 2, 3, 1, which I had divided by splicing in the two alternative versions of the Bodhisattva's quest for the path to enlightenment. We now rejoin the Buddha immediately after his enlightenment as he ponders the weighty question whether to attempt to share his realization with the world. Just at this point, in the midst of a text that has so far appeared so convincingly naturalistic, a deity named Brahma Sahampati descends from the heavens to plead with the Buddha to wander forth and teach the Dhamma for the benefit of those with little dust in their eyes. Should this scene be interpreted literally, or as a symbolic enactment of an internal drama taking place in the Buddha's mind? It is hard to give a definitive answer to this question. Perhaps the scene could be understood as occurring at both levels at once. In any event, Brahma's appearance at this point marks a shift from the realism that colors the earlier part of the sutta back toward the mythical symbolic mode. The transition again underscores the cosmic significance of the Buddha's enlightenment and his future mission as a teacher. Brahma's appeal eventually prevails, and the Buddha agrees to teach. He chooses as the first recipients of his teaching the five ascetics who had attended on him during his years of ascetic practices. The narrative culminates in a brief statement that the Buddha instructed them in such a way that they all attained the deathless Nibbana for themselves. However, it gives no indication of the specific teaching that the Buddha imparted to them when he first met them after his enlightenment. That teaching is the first discourse itself, known as the setting in motion of the wheel of the Dhamma. This sutta is included here as text 2.5. When the sutta opens, the Buddha announces to the five ascetics that he has discovered the middle way, which he identifies with the Noble Eightfold Path. In the light of the preceding biographical account, we can understand why the Buddha should begin his discourse in this way. The five ascetics had initially refused to acknowledge the Buddha's claim to enlightenment and spurned him as one who had betrayed the higher calling to revert to a life of luxury. Thus, he first had to assure them that, far from reverting to a life of self-indulgence, he had discovered a new approach to the timeless quest for enlightenment. This new approach, he told them, remains faithful to the renunciation of sensual pleasures, yet eschews tormenting the body as pointless and unproductive. He then explained to them the true path to liberation, the Noble Eightfold Path, which avoids the two extremes and thereby gives rise to the light of wisdom and culminates in the destruction of all bondage, Nibbana. Once he has cleared up their misunderstanding, the Buddha then proclaims the truths he had realized on the night of his enlightenment. These are the four noble truths. Not only does he enunciate each truth and briefly define its meaning, but he describes each truth from three perspectives. These constitute the three turnings of the wheel of the Dhamma, referred to later in the discourse. With respect to each truth, the first turning is the wisdom that illuminates the particular nature of that noble truth. The second turning is the understanding that each noble truth imposes a particular task to be accomplished. Thus, the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, is to be fully understood. The second truth, the truth of suffering's origin or craving, is to be abandoned. The third truth, the truth of cessation of suffering, is to be realized. And the fourth truth, the truth of the path, is to be developed. The third turning is the understanding that the four functions regarding the four noble truths have been completed. The truth of suffering has been fully understood. Craving has been abandoned. The cessation of suffering has been realized. And the path has been fully developed. It was only when he understood the four noble truths in these three turnings and 12 modes, he says, that he could claim that he had attained unsurpassed, perfect enlightenment. The Dhammakakkappavattana Sutta illustrates once again the blending of the two stylistic modes I referred to earlier. The discourse proceeds almost entirely in the realistic, naturalistic mode until we approach the end, when the Buddha completes his sermon. The cosmic significance of the event is illuminated by a passage showing how the deities in each successive celestial realm applaud the discourse and shout the good news up to the deities in the next higher realm. At the same time, the entire world system quakes and shakes, and a great light, surpassing the radiance of the gods, appears in the world. Then, at the very end, we return from this glorious scene back to the prosaic human realm, to behold the Buddha briefly congratulating the ascetic Kondanya for gaining the dust-free, stainless vision of the Dhamma. In one split second, the lamp of the doctrine has passed from master to disciple, to begin its journey throughout India and across the world. Chapter 2. The Bringer of Light. Part 1. One Person. Monks, there is one person who arises in the world for the welfare of the multitude, for the happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the good, welfare, and happiness of devas and humans. Who is that one person? It is the Tathagata, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one. This is that one person. Monks, there is one person arising in the world who is unique, without a peer, without counterpart, incomparable, unequaled, matchless, unrivaled, the best of humans. Who is that one person? It is the Tathagata, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one. This is that one person. Monks, the manifestation of one person is the manifestation of great vision, of great light, of great radiance. It is the manifestation of the six things unsurpassed, the realization of the four analytical knowledges, the penetration of the various elements, of the diversity of elements. It is the realization of the fruit of knowledge and liberation, the realization of the fruits of stream entry, once returning, non-returning, and arahantship. Who is that one person? It is the Tathagata, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one. This is that one person. Anguttara Nikaya 1, 13, 1, 5, 6, 1, 22 through 23. Part 2. The Buddha's Conception and Birth. 1. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savathi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. 2. Now a number of monks were sitting in the assembly hall, where they had met together on returning from their alms round, after their meal, when this discussion arose among them. It is wonderful, friends, it is marvelous, how mighty and powerful is the Tathagata, for he is able to know about the Buddhas of the past, who attained final Nibbana, cut the tangle of proliferation, broke the cycle, ended the round, and surmounted all suffering. That for those blessed ones their birth was thus, their names were thus, their clans were thus, their moral discipline was thus, their qualities of concentration were thus, their wisdom was thus, their meditative dwellings were thus, their liberation was thus. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda told the monks, "Friends, Tathagatas are wonderful and have wonderful qualities. Tathagatas are marvelous and have marvelous qualities." However, their discussion was interrupted, for the Blessed One rose from meditation when it was evening, went to the assembly hall, and sat down on a seat made ready. Then he addressed the monks thus, "Monks, for what discussion are you sitting together here now? And what was your discussion that was interrupted?" "Here, Venerable Sir, we were sitting in the assembly hall, where we had met together on returning from our alms round, after our meal, when this discussion arose among us. It is wonderful, friends, it is marvelous. Their liberation was thus. When this was said, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Ananda said to us, 'Friends, Tathagatas are wonderful and have wonderful qualities. Tathagatas are marvelous and have marvelous qualities.' This was our discussion, Venerable Sir, that was interrupted when the Blessed One arrived." Then the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Ananda, "That being so, Ananda, explain more fully the Tathagata's wonderful and marvelous qualities." 3. "I heard and learned this, Venerable Sir, from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and clearly comprehending, Ananda, the Bodhisatta appeared in the Tusita heaven. That mindful and clearly comprehending the Bodhisatta appeared in the Tusita heaven, this I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 4. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and clearly comprehending the Bodhisatta remained in the Tusita heaven. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 5. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. For the whole of his lifespan, the Bodhisatta remained in the Tusita heaven. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 6. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and clearly comprehending, the Bodhisatta passed away from the Tusita heaven and descended into his mother's womb. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 7. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisatta passed away from the Tusita heaven and descended into his mother's womb, an immeasurable great radiance surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas appeared in the world with its Devas, Mara and Brahma, in this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, with its Devas and human beings, and even in those abysmal world intervals of vacancy, gloom, and utter darkness, where the moon and the sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail. There too an immeasurable great radiance surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas appeared. And the beings reborn there perceived each other by that light. So indeed, there are also other beings reborn here. And this 10,000-fold world system shook, quaked, and trembled. And again an immeasurable great radiance surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas appeared in the world. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 8. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisatta had descended into his mother's womb, four young Devas came to guard him at the four quarters, so that no humans or non-humans or anyone at all could harm the Bodhisatta or his mother. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 9. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisatta had descended into his mother's womb, she became intrinsically virtuous, refraining from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from sexual misconduct, from false speech, and from wines, liquors, and intoxicants, the basis of negligence. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 14. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Other women give birth after carrying the child in the womb for 9 or 10 months, but not so the Bodhisatta's mother. The Bodhisatta's mother gave birth after carrying him in her womb for exactly 10 months. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 15. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Other women give birth seated or lying down, but not so the Bodhisatta's mother. The Bodhisatta's mother gave birth to him standing up. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 16. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisatta came forth from his mother's womb, first Devas received him, then human beings. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 17. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisatta came forth from his mother's womb, he did not touch the earth. The four young Devas received him and set him before his mother, saying, "Rejoice, O Queen! A son of great power has been born to you." This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 18. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisatta came forth from his mother's womb, he came forth unsullied, unsmeared by water, humors, blood, or any kind of impurity, clean and unsullied. Suppose there were a gem placed on fine cloth. Then the gem would not smear the cloth, or the cloth the gem. Why is that? Because of the purity of both. So too when the Bodhisatta came forth. He came forth clean and unsullied. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 19. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisatta came forth from his mother's womb, two jets of water appeared to pour from the sky, one cool and one warm, for bathing the Bodhisatta and his mother. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 20. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. As soon as the Bodhisatta was born, he stood firmly with his feet on the ground. Then he took 7 steps facing north, and with a white parasol held over him, He surveyed each quarter and uttered the words of the leader of the herd. I am the highest in the world. I am the best in the world. I am the foremost in the world. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewed existence for me. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 21. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, an immeasurable great radiance, surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas, appeared in the world with its Devas, Mara and Brahma. In this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, with its Devas and human beings, and even in those abysmal world intervals of vacancy, gloom, and utter darkness, where the moon and the sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail. There too, an immeasurable great radiance surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas appeared in the world, and the beings reborn there perceived each other by that light. So indeed, there are also other beings reborn here, and this 10,000-fold world system shook, quaked, and trembled. And there too an immeasurable great radiance surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas appeared in the world. That when the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, an immeasurable great radiance surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas appeared in the world. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 22. That being so, Ananda, remember this too as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. Hear, Ananda, for the Tathagata feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Perceptions are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Thoughts are known as they are present, as they disappear. Remember this too, Ananda, as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. Venerable Sir, since for the Blessed One feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear, perceptions are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Thoughts are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. That is what the Venerable Ananda said. The teacher approved. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Ananda's words. Majjhima Nikaya, 123. Akcharya Abhuta Sutta. Abridged. 3. 118 through 120. 122 through 124. Part 3. The Quest for Enlightenment. Verse 1. Seeking the Supreme State of Sublime Peace. 5. Monks, there are these two kinds of search, the noble search and the ignoble search. And what is the ignoble search? Here someone being himself subject to birth seeks what is also subject to birth. Being himself subject to aging, he seeks what is also subject to aging. Being himself subject to sickness, he seeks what is also subject to sickness. Being himself subject to death, he seeks what is also subject to death. Being himself subject to sorrow, he seeks what is also subject to sorrow. Being himself subject to defilement, he seeks what is also subject to defilement. 6 through 11. And what may be said to be subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death, to sorrow and defilement, wife and children, men and women, slaves, goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, gold and silver. These acquisitions are subject to birth, aging, sickness and death, to sorrow and defilement. And one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly absorbed in them, being himself subject to birth, to sorrow and defilement, seeks what is also subject to birth, to sorrow and defilement. 12. And what is the noble search? Here, someone being himself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeks the unborn supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, being himself subject to aging. Having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, he seeks the unaging supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, being himself subject to sickness. Having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, he seeks the unailing supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, being himself subject to death. Having understood the danger in what is subject to death, he seeks the deathless supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, being himself subject to sorrow. Having understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, he seeks the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, being himself subject to defilement. Having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, he seeks the undefiled supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. This is the noble search. 13. Monks, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what was also subject to birth. Being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I sought what was also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. Then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, do I seek what is also subject to birth? Why, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, do I seek what is also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement? Suppose that, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek the unborn supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. Suppose that, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I seek the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. 14. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. 15. Having gone forth, monks, in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Alara Kalama and said to him, Friend Kalama, I want to lead the spiritual life in this Dhamma and discipline. Alara Kalama replied, The Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and dwell in it, realizing for himself, through direct knowledge, his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dhamma. As far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed, I know and see, and there were others who did likewise. I considered, it is not through mere faith alone that Alara Kalama declares. By realizing it for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and dwell in this Dhamma. Certainly, Alara Kalama dwells knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, Friend Kalama, in what way do you declare that by realizing it for yourself with direct knowledge, you enter upon and dwell in this Dhamma? In reply, he declared the base of nothingness. I considered, not only Alara Kalama has faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Alara Kalama declares he enters upon and dwells in by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and dwelled in that Dhamma by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, Friend Kalama, Is it in this way that you declare that you enter upon and dwell in this Dhamma by realizing it for yourself with direct knowledge? That is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and dwell in this Dhamma by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge. It is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our fellow monk. So, the Dhamma that I declare I enter upon and dwell in by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that you enter upon and dwell in by realizing it for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and dwell in by realizing it for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that I declare I enter upon and dwell in by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that I know, and I know the Dhamma that you know. As I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. Come, friend, let us now lead this community together. Thus Alara Kalama, my teacher, placed me, his pupil, on an equal footing with himself, and awarded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana, but only to rebirth in the base of nothingness, not being satisfied with that Dhamma. Disappointed with it, I left. 16. Still in search, monks, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Udaka Ramaputta and said to him, Friend, I want to lead the spiritual life in this Dhamma and discipline. Udaka Ramaputta replied, The Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and dwell in it, himself realizing through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dhamma. As far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of this teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed I know and see, and there were others who did likewise. I considered, it was not through mere faith alone that Rama declared, by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and dwell in this Dhamma. Certainly, Rama dwelled knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Then I went to Udaka Ramaputta and asked him, Friend, in what way did Rama declare that by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge, he entered upon and dwelled in this Dhamma? In reply, Udaka Ramaputta declared the base of neither perception nor non-perception. I considered, not only Rama had faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and dwelled in by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and dwelled in that Dhamma by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Udaka Ramaputta and asked him, Friend, was it in this way that Rama declared that he entered upon and dwelled in this Dhamma by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge? That is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and dwell in this Dhamma by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge. It is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our fellow monk. So the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and dwelled in by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that you enter upon and dwell in by realizing it for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and dwell in by realizing it for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and dwelled in by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that Rama knew, and Rama knew the Dhamma that you know. As Rama was, so are you. As you are, so was Rama. Come, friend, now lead this community. Thus, Udaka Ramaputta, my fellow monk, placed me in the position of a teacher and accorded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana, but only to rebirth in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, disappointed with it, I left. 17. Still in search, monks, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by stages through the Magadhan country until eventually I arrived at Uruvela, near Senanigama. There, I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks, and nearby a village for alms resort. I considered, this is an agreeable piece of ground. This is a delightful grove with a clear flowing river, with pleasant smooth banks, and a nearby village for alms resort. This will serve for the striving of a clansman intent on striving. And I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. 18. Then, monks, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to aging, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, seeking the unaging supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unaging supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to sickness, having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, seeking the unailing supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unailing supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to death, having understood the danger in what is subject to death, seeking the deathless supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the deathless supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to sorrow, having understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, seeking the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, seeking the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. The knowledge and vision arose in me. My liberation is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no more renewed existence. From Majjhima Nikaya 26, Ariya Pariyasana Sutta. 1. 160 through 167. Verse 2. The realization of the three true knowledges. 11. Sakaka asked the Blessed One, has there never arisen in Master Gotama a feeling so pleasant that it could invade his mind and remain? Has there never arisen in Master Gotama a feeling so painful that it could invade his mind and remain? 12. Why not Agivesana? Here, Agivesana, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisatta, I thought, household life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy, while living in a home, to lead the holy life utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. 13 through 16. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, as in text 2, 3, 1, 14 through 17. And I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. 17. Now these three similes occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying in water, and a man came with an upper fire stick, thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. What do you think, Agivesana? Could the man light a fire and produce heat by taking the upper fire stick and rubbing it against the wet, sappy piece of wood lying in the water? No, Master Gautama. Why not? Because it is a wet, sappy piece of wood, and it is lying in water. Eventually the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So too, Agivesana, as to those ascetics and Brahmins who still do not live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, and whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst and fever for sensual pleasures has not been fully abandoned and suppressed internally. Even if those good ascetics and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. And even if those good ascetics and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. This was before the first simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. 18. Again, Agivesana. A second simile occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying on dry land far from water, and a man came with an upper fire stick thinking, I shall light a fire. I shall produce heat. What do you think, Agivesana? Could the man light a fire and produce heat by taking the upper fire stick and rubbing it against the wet, sappy piece of wood lying on dry land far from water? No, Master Gautama. Why not? Because it is a wet, sappy piece of wood. Even though it is lying on dry land far from water, eventually the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So too, Agivesana, as to those ascetics and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, but whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual pleasures has not been fully abandoned and suppressed internally. Even if those good ascetics and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. And even if those good ascetics and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. This was the second simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. 19. Again, Agivesana. A third simile occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water. And a man came with an upper fire stick, thinking, I shall light a fire. I shall produce heat. What do you think, Agivesana? Could the man light a fire and produce heat by rubbing it against the dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water? Yes, Master Gautama. Why so? Because it is a dry, sapless piece of wood, and it is lying on dry land far from water. So too, Agivesana, as to those ascetics and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, and whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual pleasures has been fully abandoned and suppressed internally. Even if those good ascetics and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. And even if those good ascetics and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. This was the third simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. These are the three similes that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before.